fellow writers, you have found Catherine's Corner of the Scriptarian Society, where we discuss specific books from the writer's perspective. Here with me, Carissa, aka Lewis, aka Catherine, we discuss the writer's side of reading to analyze some of the specifics that makes a book work or not work on a literary level. Today, we're going to be talking about a really underrated series from a really famous author. Will there be spoilers? Yes. So, you know the drill. If that bothers you, go read the book and come back. If it doesn't, welcome. I'm here to give you writers some advice and you readers some extra content on a book series you loved. So, with no further ado, let's talk about The Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis. It's also called The Cosmic Trilogy. So if you've heard that one before, you can call it either The Space Trilogy or The Cosmic Trilogy. Both work. To start off, can we just talk about C.S. Lewis? I love this man. If you listen to the main episodes or the intro here, you know that my nickname is Lewis and Ashes is Tolkien. That's because in college, we took an entire class on Tolkien, only Ash took it first, and so she called herself Tolkien and made me Lewis. Am I complaining about this? No, absolutely not. Does it fit? No, not really. Our styles are so much more similar the opposite way. I am much more of a Tolkien writer, spending years on the same story and cultivating every detail, focusing on world building and epic plot and enormous conclusions. And Ash is definitely more of a write fun zany stories and they will come type, which is very C.S. Lewis. But while I acknowledge my own style is very Tolkien-esque, I think I enjoy C.S. Lewis's books more. This might be because he simply wrote more, and so there's a greater body of work to obsess over, but I also really love that he manages to take kind of weird, kind of creative things and turn them intellectual. His nonfiction is fantastic. Narnia, of course, is beloved, and he even delved into sci-fi. First of all, he actually had a partially completed short story about alternate universes that he died before he could finish, which is really disappointing. It's pretty cool what exists of it. It's highly based on the Inklings, which was the group of friends he and Tolkien were a part of, but it doesn't have an ending, so it's frustrating to read. But he also has an entire trilogy, the one we're going to talk about today, based on space travel. Book one is about a journey to Mars, book two to Venus, and book three is just a crazy, insane conclusion to all the things coming to a head after the discoveries made in the first two books. It is fantastic, and I wish more people would read it, so here's your sign to do just that. But for those of us who've already read it, or don't care to, let's first talk about how sci-fi changes over the years. I recently read Journey to the Center of the Earth by Jules Verne and noted how a lot of older sci-fi seems to be based around exploring Earth itself as opposed to space. Why? Because when those novels were written, Earth hadn't been as highly explored as it is now. It only makes sense that that would be the focus of older sci-fi novels because a large purpose of sci-fi is to imagine what might be true. That's going to change depending on what you know to be true. Someone on TikTok recently described their love for sci-fi as fantasy that might really be out there. And that's such a great statement. It sort of renewed my appreciation for the genre. Back when Verne and Wells and other famous sci-fi writers published their books, there were still a lot of scientific questions out there. There were still quandaries, science that didn't seem to fit, and theories that couldn't yet be proven. But here's the thing about science, that's still the case. That's always going to be the case. No matter what your perspective on science is, you can't deny that we don't have all the answers. While we've found answers to some things, like whether or not there is something at the center of the Earth, there are still questions about the origin of the species, the bottom of the ocean, and, as is the usual direction of modern sci-fi, what else is out in the universe to discover. So if you're a sci-fi writer, that's really your job. Exploration. It doesn't have to be out in space, but it has to be the exploration of something. And the hard thing about sci-fi is that there's a very good chance that one day you will be proven wrong. Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth is technically outdated now. We know it's not possible, so it seems more like fantasy now. But at the time, it was so interesting to people because, for all they knew, it could have been true. And people still read his books and Wells despite the debunking of a lot of their theories. Part of this is because they were never true theories. It was always meant to be fiction, meant to entertain and consider what it might mean if something was true. That's why debunked science gets thrown out and ceases to be studied, while debunked science fiction tends to keep its popularity. But there is no question that sci-fi is inevitably going to be proven right or wrong. I guess it could just remain a possibility for all of time. But you're probably going to be proven right or wrong in some facet, and you kind of just have to deal with that as a sci-fi writer, that you're probably eventually going to be disproven. Keeping all of that in mind, the first thing we have to consider about C.S. Lewis's space trilogy is that it was written in the early 1900s, and it is scientifically inaccurate. They travel into space way too easily on a spaceship that could not reasonably function, they breathe on planets that don't have an atmosphere, and they build theories that we know today can't be true. But with science fiction, the exact specifics are never what is important. Yes, I think it's right to use the science available to you to come up with reasonable possibilities in your sci-fi book. You know more than Lewis did, or can at least research more than he had access to back then. Suspension of disbelief in science fiction is highly related to what could have been understood at the time, and how good of a job you do making it seem logical. But regardless, I think all Lewis's points can still stand despite the scientific inaccuracies. I don't think it's a flaw, it's a sign of its time. It's a perspective we are never going to see again, so I don't think it's a flaw. And that's because he wasn't actually exploring Mars or Venus in this trilogy. As the Christian he was exploring what life on Earth might have looked like had early man made different moral decisions. The part of the premise in book one is that when he gets to Mars and meets the Martians, the entire universe knows about Earth and feels bad for them because Earth is this planet that this great tragedy has happened to, and that's not the case for these other creatures on these other planets. In book two, which explores Venus, we see this world that has just gotten its Adam and Eve. It's behind Earth, whereas Mars is more equivalent or ahead of. The Eve character in this world chooses not to eat the equivalent of the apple. So what does this mean for their developing world? What really went down with Earth's Eve that makes our reality true? And how might people that didn't make that mistake look at us? That's the real question Lewis was exploring, and because it's human, because it's universal, it still holds up even though it's written in a universe that can't exist. So reading books like this, your suspension of disbelief has to be stretched because you have to be fair to the author and the time they wrote the book in. Are there scientists out there that probably cringe and can't enjoy books like this? Probably. Can you be one of them even if you're not a scientist? Perhaps, and that's fine. You like what you like, you're going to be able to handle certain suspensions of disbelief and not others. But I do think we need to gauge the value of science fiction on its time period and the core questions it was attempting to answer, rather than whether or not it was prophetic. It would be super cool to write a science fiction book that turned out to be true, I feel that, but it would also be super unlikely. And it's just cool to explore the answers to questions science can't yet tackle, to ask a question no one has before. And that gives these older sci-fi authors some credit in my book, despite the sometimes annoying inaccuracies. Really, the key to making a sci-fi book long-term interesting, aside from just addressing universal, no pun intended, questions, is to make sure that you are explaining everything as logically as you can. Science is part logic as well as fact, and so sci-fi should be relatively logical in its explanations. Don't bog your story down too much in the scientific nitty-gritty, especially if it's a theory or alternate explanation rather than actual scientific fact, but make sure that the logic of how certain things exist and why is being addressed. If you give readers a viable explanation, they usually don't care if it's true, they only care if they can believe it for the length of the story. You can be technically wrong and it will still be fine. It's kind of like in fantasy, right? We know, at least as far as we can, that the worlds of Caraval and Mirror Visitor and Middle-earth don't exist. We still believe them while we're reading because their explanations are so profound and minimal. So that's how I'd advise you to handle believability in your sci-fi novel. Make sure that what you're giving readers is believable and logical and fair, but also don't go into so much detail that holes are going to really obviously appear. The only real problem I see with sci-fi is that there isn't enough of it in the world. And part of the reason for that is because of, well, science. Every generation, every batch of people on planet Earth at any given time are basically asking the same scientific questions and aware of the same scientific facts. Science is a peer-reviewed field. Scientists all talk to each other, and while they're all individuals who have unique theories and studies and beliefs, This does create a sort of inner circle for the scientists of the world. The rest of us sort of take what they say to heart when it comes to what questions to even ask. And this changes by generation, but it doesn't really change by region or person. I'm being very broad here to illustrate why I think space operas are so common. Space is, for better or worse, the last great frontier. You don't see a lot of sci-fi stories exploring the ocean, or the center of the Earth, or biology. They used to, which is why a lot of older sci-fi books are still very appealing to us, because they are different, they are more varied despite being the same genre. But most sci-fi books these days explore the universe, and that's because those are the questions still being asked by the most famous names in science today. There's nothing wrong with this, except that sci-fi then tends to take on really similar, consistent world building. And make no mistake, sci-fi requires just as much world building as fantasy. If you don't actually know what's out in the universe, you have to imagine. And you have to build on that. So while I love space operas, they do tend to saturate the genre, which means that very few of them stick out as unique. Now, the space trilogy, even given it is a space opera in a sense, stands out to me because of the unique way Lewis built the worlds on these other planets. Venus is one of the coolest places I've ever read about, the version of Venus that C.S. Lewis came up with. It's so cool. I still think about it and its implications to this day. On Venus, the land masses move, like with the currents of the ocean, like a bouncy castle. The ground beneath you will fluctuate, and this changes how plants grow, how people eat, how they walk around, how culture and perspective and time and science and responsibility and everything work for the creatures there. That's so interesting. The culture on Mars has several different equally intelligent and dominant species who showcase diverse religions and worldviews and prejudices too similar to Earth to be completely an accident. Is this what we would find if we found life on other planets? Would these other life forms be kinder than we are if they never experienced a fall with a capital F of man? Or would they be crueler, created less in the image of God? Both of these worlds, the Mars and the Venus of the space trilogy, are so distinct both from one another and from Earth, and from all the other science fiction books about space exploration that I've read. C.S. Lewis stays closer to Earth in his books, yet illustrates far more creativity in his world building than many other sci-fi books. And again, I'm not trying to slam sci-fi authors here. They are, maybe more than any other genre, products of their time, and that is not easy to break out from. But there are certain staples of the genre that are just givens by now, even though they don't need to be. Other sentient humanoid life forms ruling other planets. FTL drives to make space travel easier. Certain designs to spaceships, and on and on. And I love all this. It's a genre, after all. I loved Contagion by Aaron Bowman, and I live for the Illumini Files, and The Forgetting was a surprise sci-fi that bent all my expectations. They were all unique and standout and thought-provoking, and while there are books that focus maybe more on aliens, like The Fifth Wave, instead of space travel, they do all seem to have a lot of traits in common. We seem to have this general assumption about what space travel and aliens and other planets would be like that is very consistent across the board. Star systems and planetary alliances and a certain type of alien and a certain type of travel and etc. The real epic details of sci-fi today are usually in the creative and tension-building specifics rather than the imaginative whole, unlike books of the past which seem to explore different factors of science entirely. I think Lewis's version stands out both because he came from another time and because he was attempting to answer questions I don't think all sci-fi authors today are. If you are going to write sci-fi, I would suggest finding a question to answer that you don't hear discussed a lot. Remember, there doesn't have to be a viable answer available for writing about it to be valuable. Don't copy the science. Think about it on a literary level. Think about things from a different angle than a scientist would. I hold that that will impact your world building enough to make your book super unique. And whatever your worldview is in general, build that into your world building. Sci-fi is one of the easiest places to do that. Do you believe in God? If you do, add evidences of this in the way that life develops on other planets in your world and what explorers would find out there. If you don't, provide an explanation or a culture of aliens that have a totally new perspective on time or morality to explain how this can be. Whatever your strongest worldview opinions are, sci-fi creates a lot of opportunities to build them in by providing essential fictional proof that you are right so that you can then go deeper. And that's what Lewis did, and that's why I think it works and stands out as such an interesting series. I'm not really sure where else to put this point, so I will just leave it here. The main character of the first two books is named Ransom, which is super cool and unique, and I just like it. Coming up with unique names can be a good way to add some emphasis onto your main character. I wouldn't overdo it, but you can certainly try something like that. The weird thing about this series is that the point of view changes for book three. Ransom is in the book, but he's not really the point of view character. It's this couple that is still on Earth. And everything kind of comes together. There is a similar plot function going on, right? But the characters and the point of view change. I don't know that I would advise doing this. If you change the point of view for every book, if you have a trilogy and there's a different main character or point of view character for book one, for book two, and then for book three, I think that's great. But it is kind of weird to change the point of view for book three. That's one of the reasons book three was a little jarring. So that's probably the one negative I would say about this series, and I would caution you away from that. Older authors seem to have followed fewer rules, if that makes sense. We have certain expectations now about how a series will work. You have to be consistent in first person or third person, in past or present, in point of view characters, and you can only change it up if you're doing it for a really specific reason. I see why Lewis did it here. I understand, but I still wish he'd found a way to just, you know, slip Ransom in and make him the main character still. But you can play around with those traditionally accepted, consistent norms. You can change from past to present if at some point in the series you come across the point where the person started telling the story. You can change the point of view character if there is a really strong reason why someone else needs to be telling the story, like maybe your main character died or they're not in the right location. That's basically what was happening here. Ransom just wasn't in the right place to be our narrator anymore, but I think things could have been manipulated to keep him in narrative position, but it's certainly something you can try. I think it's very hit or miss. I think people expect a certain consistency out of series. I think we give older authors some leeway because that wasn't as much the expectation. So, I mean, that could change. Again, for us, the pendulum swing could cut back around, but it's a risk. So keep that in mind. Now, and I am going to go on about this one, let's talk about the quote-worthiness of these books. Quote-worthiness is kind of a factor I really care about, and it's really going to come from that place I already talked about when you're bringing up questions and answers unique to your story. Generic quotes can work. A lot of poetic versions of I love you go that way, but I'm talking quotes that make people think even if they don't have the entire context of the book to work with. The quotes that word things just right, whether it is a new concept or even a concept that's become so common it's lost its meaning, like I love you, and these quotes say what we want to but can never quite manage. Those are the ones I highlight in my books I own. I use a highlighter because I want to be able to flip through and find those to remember what that story did to me. It's kind of that sum up point. One-liners are fantastic. Paragraphs are also great. They can act as conversation starters or really thought provokers for the readers who are getting the full context. They put the story in the perspective the writer wants you to consider. They do need to fit. Don't add a quote to sound flowery and deep that doesn't fit your book, and don't have a character say it who normally wouldn't speak that way. And as I've talked about before, do not preach at your readers, but the books in the Space Trilogy are great models on how to provide true commentary on the story you've created, weaving details in seamlessly enough that they don't register as preaching. They have to be plot or character or theme or something relevant. They have to do more than one thing. Let me give you a few examples, short and long, to kind of illustrate what I'm talking about. So first up, in Paralandra, book two, Ransom is talking to the Eve equivalent, trying to convince her not to give in to temptation for the sake of her growing world. He says, "Of course good came of it. Is Maladil a beast that we can stop his path or a leaf that we can twist his shape? Whatever you do, he will make good of it, but not the good he had prepared for you if you had obeyed him. That is lost forever. The first king and first mother of our world did the forbidden thing, and he brought good of it in the end. But what they did was not good, and what they lost we have not seen. And there are some to whom no good came, nor ever will come." So I love that quote. See how that's related to the theme of how a world without a fall might operate, how someone from a world with a fall would view someone that has the chance to do different. It doesn't, at least to me, come across as preachy, even though there's some obvious religious themes in there, but it doesn't come across preachy to me because this scene is literally Ransom attempting to convince this other character not to make the same choice Eve once did. It's a discussion, an argument, and it directly affects the choice that she makes next. So it's plot relevant as well as theme relevant and character relevant because Ransom is making these discoveries for himself as he considers the implications of the Venus world. We don't pause the story to go off on a tangent or say something that we have to struggle to connect with the plot. It's all related. So C.S. Lewis is able to say what he wants to say and kind of explain things to us in a summing up way while still carrying the story along with it rather than pausing it. For our second example, I do not think the forest would be so bright, nor the water so warm, nor love so sweet if there were no danger in the lakes. This is also a great quote for an exploration type of story. It's kind of that rationale for how someone can take danger alongside adventure. And I think Ransom says this. I'm pretty sure. Might have been Weston, but I think it was Ransom. It was one of them. And it's just talking about why some people want to explore and how they can take danger, which is a theme of sci-fi, a theme of the worlds. It's a short and pithy enough quote that it doesn't distract us for long or anything. And it is also related to the actions that they are taking plot-wise. So, third example, this is my absolute favorite quote from the book. And, the final line of this paragraph that I'm going to read you is my favorite quote. This line shows a hearkening back to an old idea rather than creating a totally new one. So it words it well and creates a different point, even though it's kind of... You'll see. So here's the line. He had read of space. At the back of his thinking for years had lurked the dismal fancy of the black, cold vacuity, the utter deadness which was supposed to separate the worlds. He had not known how much it affected him till now. Now that the very name space seemed a blasphemous libel for this empyrean ocean of radiance in which they swam. He could not call it dead. He felt life pouring into him from it every moment. How indeed should it be otherwise, since out of this ocean all the worlds and all their life had come? He had thought it barren. He now saw that it was the womb of worlds, whose blazing and innumerable offspring looked down nightly even upon the earth with so many eyes, and here with how many more? No, space was the wrong name. Older thinkers had been wiser when they named it simply the heavens. Oh, gosh, that gives me chills. I love the end. It's such a profound, different perspective on how to view space. So relevant to the world Lewis is creating and to the genre. It's such a beautiful way to set the stage and comment on what's about to happen and what already has. It shows that Lewis cares about the concepts he's writing about as well as that he has a unique take on them. I've never heard space described quite this way before, and no other descriptions have hit me so hard and made me feel so small and yet so invested. It's fantastic. Anyway, moving on to the fourth one. So at this point, I believe again in book two, Ransom is noticing that his companion Weston is changed for the worse by their discoveries, which is another great idea to consider in sci-fi. It's not always going to go well. So Lewis writes, Ransom perceived that he had never before seen anything but half-hearted and uneasy attempts at evil. This creature was wholehearted. The extremity of its evil had passed beyond all struggle into some state which bore a horrible similarity to innocence. It was beyond vice as the lady was beyond virtue. So first of all, we have that internal metaphor. The lady, it's capitalized with an L, is the Eve equivalent on Venus. That's what he calls her. And Ransom has already discussed how profound and interesting her innocence is, having not been subject to a capital F fall. This is a concept we have established in the story, one non-readers aren't going to understand, and it's now being used to communicate a foil, the foil of Weston's personal fall in a still pure world. And foils are a great way to make a point in literature, whether it's broad or specific in a sentence like this. Counteracting each other, they make stronger points for both. And secondly, why I love this quote is that this is yet again plot relevant. It's telling us something we need to know about the changes that have come over Weston while still making a statement on morality and worldview and evil. the idea of evil appearing almost similar to innocence or surpassing struggle is a worldview concept. I think it's very interesting. And it also goes to foreshadow how book three is going to go down. It tells us something about Weston and provides a sense of unease to the story. So it's giving us tension. It's also making a point without preaching. Quoteworthiness is, in essence, a metaphor. See how these lines are relevant to the aspects that drive people to read and enjoy reading, like character and plot, while also saying something deeper. Their conversations, or their observations of a man in a profound new world, or their simple motives and explanations to drive forward a more believable story. With C.S. Lewis, it's not even his word choice that's always on point. It's the way he can create metaphors and sentence structures to make complex things feel graspable. It's why I love him. And so as you're writing, word choice may be the tool you use to create quoteworthiness. It may be sentence structure, like Lewis. It may be metaphors or allegories or conversations or observant main characters or hyperbole or anything in between. But I think to really write a story that is going to resound with readers, you should in some way be striving to make a unique or underdeveloped complex concept graspable. It's going to take a few tries. I really doubt Lewis did all of these on the first draft. It's going to take experience. It's going to come more easily with time and as you critically think through your worldview more to better communicate it. But most importantly, you must try. You may be writing along and spit out a line you weren't even expecting that sums up exactly what you're trying to say. And that might help you know what you're trying to say. Those are the kinds of moments you want to give to readers too. You don't want to repeat yourself or get preachy, but you want to give them a line that can kind of drive that point home. Even if you are, like Lewis, a little on the zanier side of the writer spectrum, I think that's really what makes the difference between a good and a great book. Now, you may be saying to yourself, this doesn't sound like that zany of a series. What does she mean that C.S. Lewis is a zany writer? Let's talk about the ending of book three. This whole thing ends. This isn't even a real spoiler. In all of the bad guys in the series in one room, and then this parade of zoo animals spills into said room and demolishes them. I am not kidding. Some people get trampled, some get eaten, some get killed for sport. It is the bloodiest, most bizarre scene I have ever read in a book. This is something C.S. Lewis wrote, along with that intense, vivid line about space. It is insane. You're just reading along, having a very normal reading experience, and suddenly zoo animals ex machina come in? And it's crazy. But the buildup was there. We knew zoo animals had escaped, we just didn't know where they were. We knew something was coming, given all these guys in the same building, we just didn't know what. They were planning something heinous, and to be honest, this device acts as a sort of, oh no you don't, on a cosmic level. I think about it a lot. I think about this ending a lot. It's a bold choice, not only in terms of shock value, which is typically not great in books, but really how you can do literally anything as long as you provide foreshadowing up front. Anything. You can do anything. I kind of miss the days when bizarre endings like this were more common in literature, when, like, everyone died, or everyone was killed by zoo animals. You know, those days. It's still done pretty well in this book. It works. It's just not a trope or a traditionally satisfying ending. I'm not advising you guys to go this bizarre in an ending. But if you're gonna defeat a bad guy in your book, the cue we can take here is to start planting little conversational and foreshadowed details at the beginning of the book to make it, whether bizarre or expected, a satisfying twist at the end. The book can just open with a discussion about how the zoo is closed, and then later on, someone mentions that they saw a zebra walking around. You know, just little clues like that can make something like this actually satisfying. So, it is really interesting how book three in general is so different in tone and location and, like I said, point of view than the first two. It's jarring at first, and I was a little disappointed at the beginning because I wanted to explore more planets because, like I said, Lewis creates really interesting world building on planets. But I think it ultimately works because the series as a whole serves to look at these scientific realities and discoveries. And then book three really digs deep into the implications that the scientific discoveries have on people and their control, as opposed to leaving a more open-ended story, which is also something sci-fi should explore and often does. The power the people who make the discoveries or hijack the discoveries have on how the new information is used. You could take the exact same scientific discovery and come up with several completely different plot points strictly based on how the main character decides to utilize the information, or how the antagonist does. But I do sort of wish there had just been more books in the series between 2 and 3 to explore other planets before we came to this insane conclusion, but as it is, it's excellent. All right, that's all I have to say on C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy. Good stuff, really unique. Lesson learned? If zoo animals don't appear to trample you to death, you can't be screwing up that badly. That being said, thank you for listening, and I will see you on the next page.